Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Low Tox Life podcast. I'm Alex Stewart, your host, and today I have a really great show for you with someone who's only just recently come into my orbit through a dear friend of mine, Eleanor Antoniou. And Eleanor is an incredible sort of conscious PR expert. So she really helps brands who have conscious living and eco principles at the very core of their brand come out into the world and be discovered and get the media that they deserve. Now, Eleanor has a friend called Hannah Paris, and Hannah and Eleanor decided to go into business together with their complementary skills and create ethical, sustainable underwear. And today's subject doesn't just revolve around the creation of the Mighty Good Undie brand, but also delves into the ethical fashion industry. And also, if you like, the reason that the ethical fashion industry has had to be born, which is, of course, because of the very unsustainable way that our clothes are produced, the unsustainable way in which they're sold in the crazy numbers they are sold and bought at, and the unsustainable way that labor has been structured in many, many of these, especially fast fashion companies, but not excluding luxury brands either. So Hannah really is at the forefront of the UK ethical fashion movement, being based over there herself, even though she's an Aussie lass. And we really cover so much about ethical fashion today, so that if this is a new topic for you, or if you're just wanting to start getting a little bit more conscious around the clothes that we literally have on our backs, Hannah is just so approachable. And, you know, we really discover some fantastic tips from her that I hadn't even thought of myself in today's chat about how to become a little bit more sustainable in the way we choose, buy, reuse, and on gift our clothing items. So I hope you enjoy today's chat. And there are a stack of resources today in the show notes. So don't forget, you can always find those at lowtoxlife.com/podcast. Enjoy today's show. Hannah Paris, how are you?
Hi, Alex. I'm really well.
That's great. It is so great to have you on the Low Tox Life podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, we're going to talk about such an important topic today, and it's one of those topics that we can very quickly think is in that too hard basket and we just can't get our head around it. And as with everything out there, it's all about empowerment and starting to trust suppliers that are authentic and traceable and all the incredible things that you're going to give us as tips around ethical / sustainable fashion today. But what I want to do before we hook into all of that is help everyone learn more about you. So can you just paint the picture for us? You're a kid. Are you one of those kids who's climbing in trees in a forest in a rural space, off-grid, eco, you know, hippie-loving parents? Or were you a city kid? Like, talk to me about childhood.
I was actually a city kid. I grew up in Sydney. I grew up in a family that had a really strong sense of social justice and was always interested in politics. And I guess I got interested in environmental issues from that perspective. And I was always curious about the world. And I just literally fell in love with nature right in the middle of, you know, Sydney suburbia. I was in quite a bushy area. I grew up in the North Shore, but our family didn't camp or didn't get involved in the outdoors at all. So it was a bit of a quirk, I must say, in my interest. But I really did become, I guess, my committed environmentalism or my passion for sustainability really started then.
Beautiful. And in terms of industries, how did you end up moving towards fashion? Was it always going to be fashion? Did you try a few different things out or?
No, it wasn't at all. In fact, I probably have the most unusual background of anybody that I've met in the fashion industry. I actually have a PhD in economics, and I have spent about 10 years working in public policy, academia, and as a consultant in environmental economics. And from there, I kind of woke up, I was in a job that was meant to be my ideal job, and I woke up one day and realised, A, I hated it, and B, I was tired and I was sick of it, because policy work is very much about looking at big picture stuff, trying to affect change, particularly through politics, and you never know whether your effort and your work is actually going to result in anything. So I decided I wanted to start a business, and I wanted to start a business that helped people specifically to lead more sustainable lives by providing a product or a service that they used every day but was delivered to them at a good price in the most sustainable way possible. And I sat down and thought through all the different systems that we use every day, our transport system, our food system, our housing, our energy, and we've made really great leaps in all of those areas. What was missing was the clothes that we wear. So I started looking into the fashion industry and the clothing industry, and it turns out that it is, I think, the second most polluting industry on the planet, has an enormous in social justice impact, and not a lot was being done about it when I started looking into this, particularly in Australia. So I decided I would start a fashion business.
Wow, so it was quite calculated and measured in the way that you analyse different industries, and it's always going to be about that one that just speaks to your heart straight away, isn't it? There's almost like a click, like, you know, seeing someone that you find attractive in a crowded room. It's the same kind of, oh my gosh, that just fits for me.
Yeah, well, also fashion is fun. There's a very fun element to it. But more seriously, I mean, everybody gets dressed in the morning. Whether you think that you're involved in fashion or not, you get dressed in the morning, and in that way you engaged with the garment industry. Even if you wear secondhand clothes or you wear ethical clothes or you wear just fast fashion, whatever you do, you're engaging with that this particular industry in some way or another. So it's really fundamental to our lives.
Absolutely. So within that, obviously, as you started to peel back the layers, looking around at this second most polluting industry that you had stumbled upon to make your work, if you like, what was it specifically? Were there a couple of injustices or pollution issues that really made you think, oh my gosh, I've got to do something?
I think it was more, I sort of approached it from the flip side of that, and I approached it from the side of, I guess, more positive framing than that. It was like I approached it from, I'm really interested in organic fabrics and particularly in organic cotton. And then once I hit that point, I started looking at all the impacts of cotton and all the benefits of organic cotton. And I also am really interested in seeing whether there was ethical supply chains out there where workers were, rights were protected and nurtured, where they were paid properly, whether they were supported. And so I knew about the fair trade system in cotton. And from there I started researching production systems. And then from that stop, you know, once I got to that point, I started learning more about why these systems exist. And I think now, looking back on it, the thing that horrifies me most about the industry is the amount of chemicals that are used, both in the growing of cotton and in the processing, particularly in the dyeing, and how that creates enormous amounts of water pollution. But on the social side of things, I'm particularly horrified about the use of child labour and forced labour and exploited labour right throughout the supply chain. So, they were the things I definitely wanted to avoid, and yeah. I found our supply chain manages successfully to do all of that.
Mm. And this is the thing with creating change and with ourselves, like our everyday people out there thinking, I am a good person and I want to do good things in the world. But like, let's just hazard a guess. If you were to go into any 22-year-old person's wardrobe who doesn't know anything about ethical fashion, sustainable fashion, would you assume, based on a wardrobe that contains, say, 100 pieces all up, that of that 100 pieces in there somewhere, there was child labour involved?
The problem is we can't tell. I wouldn't dismiss it, but particularly with Australian labels, they're not transparent enough throughout their entire supply chain. A lot of companies have in place a fairly robust policy on labour rights at what we call the first tier supply, which is where usually the factory where the garments are cut, what we call cut, make, trim. You know, they get the fabric, they cut it, they sew it, they turn it into the garment. And they usually have a certain level of policies and a certain level of oversight at that level. But they don't go beyond that. They don't know where that fabric comes from. They don't know if it's cotton, they don't know who grew it. And so we don't know whether there is exploited labour in this hidden part of the supply chain. Now, it's probably a safe assumption that there probably is in lots of ways, particularly when you're looking at the fast fashion and the budget end of the industry, because they're purchasing, you know, very cheap cotton. Cheap cotton, we know, depends on exploited or child labour. So it's not a bad assumption, but we just don't know. And that's why there's so much emphasis in the industry on transparency right throughout the supply chain.
Mm, absolutely. Now, you mentioned how unsustainable and how many chemicals are used in the farming. And this is something that I'm quite passionate about, but actually, interestingly, had a genetically modified cotton farmer write to me after I did a post on organic cotton and the benefits of it, who called me out and said I was grossly misinformed and that you can't even really do organic cotton in Australia. I haven't researched it enough to answer that gentleman yet, and I always like to put time into a reply like that, and I think it always makes me an even more informed, open-minded person when I get an email like that, because I really want to make sure that I'm don't just have my conviction or my idea of what's right, but really the science behind the things that sit well with me, if you like. Now, it seems to me it can almost bring up the question, like, should we really be growing cotton in a country where it doesn't seem to work or it isn't profitable or the farmer can't get ahead? Should a different country like India, where it does seem to do quite easily with the right tools for the farmers, you know, do you know what I'm trying to get at in
yeah,
this question?
I mean, yes, it is a broader philosophical question about agriculture in Australia. I mean, we produce in India, and one of the reasons why we produce in India is the leading supplier of organic and fair trade cotton. And India has this enormous thousands of years of history of growing cotton. It's native to that country. We've brought it here to Australia. Cotton, we do know that cotton is a very thirsty crop. Australia is the second driest continent on the planet.
Do the math.
I don't know much about the cotton industry in Australia either, but, you know, I kind of put that together and went, okay. And not only in Australia, you know, there's I don't know whether there's actually any organic farmers in Australia growing cotton.
Unfortunately, it seems not, because it just doesn't seem to work. GM cotton is a different story. So it's really interesting. Yeah. I'm at the very start of my research into it specifically for Australia, but I just thought it just set off that alarm bell in terms of geography and how certain crops are suited to certain different geographies and landscapes. You know, we know this, and it's celebrated in something like the wine industry, for example, with different grapes doing well in different soils. So why would we try and push to grow something so hard that we have to use chemicals or modified seeds if it's just not the right crop for that soil in the first place?
Yeah, look, I'd agree, and I'd love to see the research about what you find in Australia, because my knowledge is more about just generally about organic cotton and about what's happening in India, and the destructive impact that GMO cotton is having on the Indian on organic farming, organic cotton farming in India.
And what is that destructive impact?
Well, at the moment, something like, I think it's about 98% of the world's cotton is GMO.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the consequences of that for Indian farmers is that they are more easily getting into a cycle of debt and poverty because they have to buy the GMO seeds every year, then they have to buy the chemicals from the same company and all the treatments from the same company. And it gets it's a high-cost form of production.
Mm, wonderful business model for them, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's a major... Yeah, it's a major motivator for me in terms of using non-GMO cotton is that it has this enormous social and economic impact on poor farmers. But on the organic side, it's getting harder and harder for farmers to source organic cotton seeds because of the dominance of GMO cotton. So,
and is that the blowing over into neighbouring fields and therefore no longer being able to say organic and those sorts of things?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that's the case in Australia. I'm not sure about India. But in terms of, you know, the organic farmer has a lot lower costs because they buy the seeds, but they generate internally a lot of the other inputs into their farm, and that reduces the cost, input costs to their farms.
How wonderful. Mm. So obviously there's that farming of the crop, but then as you said, where we move into the factories that make the garments, and you mentioned this before, the dyes. What are these dyes? What's in them, and why are they so bad for us and the environment?
There's a whole lot of long list of dyes.
Yeah, I know. Like, give me your three worst, or even your one worst.
At the moment, we're doing a little bit of research into what's called NPEs, so nonylphenols. And basically, so nonylphenols and azo dyes are probably the two worst. Azo dyes are a form of cheap dye that's used to, create the colours, could create a reliable colour in the fabric. And that can be toxic. I'm going to have to send you the links to this. I'm sorry,
yeah,
Alex.
We'll share it's been in the a while show since notes. I've had it's okay. Azo dyes. I'll put you on the spot with something super technical. Now I feel bad.
Fortunately, a lot of Australian labels now ban the use or restrict the use of azo dyes in their products.
Oh, go but, Australia. No, fantastic.
Yeah, which is great. And a lot of countries are doing that now. With NPEs, nonylphenol, they get released into the waterways, both in – so it's used as a washing agent for fabrics, and that gets released into the waterways where it's produced, but it also carries on and becomes a residue in our own garments. And when we wash them, it gets released into our waterways. And what – and it degrades into something called, it's the other way around. It's NPEs, nonylphenol ethoxylates, and then it degrades into something called NPs in the environment. And that then becomes a hormone disruptor. And that can actually be toxic to aquatic wildlife and particularly fish wildlife. It can then enter into the human food chain.
Absolutely, because then we feed on the fish. So
yes.
Well, some of us do, and it's all coming back.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. I haven't had a look at the chemical stuff for a few weeks because we've been busy running around getting ready for the Berlin Ethical Fashion Show next week. But I do have some material that I can share on you. We have done quite a bit of research on NPEs and why we think they're a problem.
We would love that. So, yeah, let's put that in the show notes for sure.
Yeah, and the organic system that I use ensures that those toxic chemicals are banned from use within the factories.
Oh, wonderful. And that's the transparency that you as a brand have now demanded from your suppliers.
Yes.
That then encourages them to use, which is safer for their workers, safer for their town water. I mean, it works for everybody when people at any point of the chain start demanding something safer, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yep, absolutely. So the supply chain system that I use is called the Global Organic Textile Standard.
That's wonderful. Basically
ensures that the organic cotton that's bought at the farm is what's delivered in the garment at, you know, when the consumer buys it. But in addition to that, at every stage of the production process, it requires the factories to implement very high standards of environmental management and social justice programs. So, for example, it guarantees that workers are allowed to unionise. It requires factories to put in wastewater management systems, to reuse renewable energy wherever possible, to use recyclable and recycled packaging. So it has all these additional elements to it which create a package that we know when we get it from our factory, every single environmental and social element that has been addressed has been addressed.
That's so wonderful. So the tip there is, as people start to wise up and start to Google, you know, ethical fashion, sustainable fashion, because I would imagine there would still be, as there are in the chemical personal care and cleaning industries, a few greenwashers out there who try and look like they're doing the environmental thing, but they're not using this crucial additional certification, the GOTS certification, G-O-T-S, yes, that really cements that authenticity throughout the entire production and labour chain.
Yeah, and unfortunately the GOTS system is not very well known in Australia, and not very many labels actually certify, textile labels actually certify to it.
Now Can I just interrupt while I'm thinking of this? So you're obviously based in London. Do you find that it's quite well known in the UK? Are you aware of America?
It's more... a little bit. It's known a little bit more here. What's happened both in Australia and in the UK, I'm not sure about the US, is that the local organic certification agency, so in Australia that's Australian Certified Organics, and here it's the Soil Association, they credit, if a brand is certified under the GOTS, then they will co-credit and they will co-label with that product. So often garments might be carrying the ACO label or the Soil Association label because they have this GOTS system behind them. So you can look out for both, really.
Okay, great.
But even so, there's not that many brands that are certified under ACO either. So it's a bit frustrating, which is one of the reasons why I got into this in the first place.
Good on you. I mean, and it needs everybody who has that frustration, because you're the type of person who therefore has that fire in your belly to do something about it, to do the work so that everyone else can start jumping on the bandwagon and going, well, absolutely.
Yep.
Because something I find really interesting in my e-courses and chatting to people through my private coaching over the years has been helping people connect with their values. Forget making a better choice or eating better food or buying ethical fashion. Just forget all of that for a minute and think about your values as a person, what's really important to you. Is it family? Is it peace? Is it justice? Is it love? Is it, you know, and make a few kind of notes and really think about that. Then what you do as a consumer when you've got that hat on is you're really clear on your values and you start to question the choices you make more, because, you know, you're in touch with your values and you think, well, that company I know uses petroleum in their food colours and answer to their shareholders before they answer to public health. Actually, that has nothing to do with my values. It's not about whether I should or shouldn't eat that, you know, junky treat. It's actually that I wouldn't touch something from a company that has values like that. And it changes the mental conversation for people, I find, in a super effective way.
I completely agree, Alex, and I'm laughing almost in recognition. I mean, since I've got into all of this, my I've completely ruined myself for shopping.
I know.
Yeah, I know too much about what goes on behind all the fast fashion labels that you see on the high street. I guess, and I think that's really right. I think people need to think about, because one of the problems or one of the issues that ethical fashion face is that it is a higher cost than what we're used to paying because we pay too little. And so people have this, I guess, sticker price dilemma about going for a higher cost item. But if they think of it in terms of their values, they won't regret it. You know, there's no regret with buying the ethical fashion.
You really don't. And, you know, I have to be the first to admit that unlike with organic versus non-organic food, where I'm around the 90-95% organic and then 5-10% go with the flow out and about, you know, don't stress when you're at your mate's house kind of thinking. With fashion, I'm still very much 50-50, you know. I will still be a sucker for that gorgeous bright yellow gown and think, God, it's so divine, and I will buy it if I have like an event and I have to speak at something and, you know, wear something pretty. I'm almost there, but I'm definitely not 100% there yet. So I want anyone to think out there that Hannah and myself are here preaching as pictures of perfection who never make any mistakes in any area of our lives. This is not the case, and it is not true. And everyone's just trying to do the best they can. So I'm checking in here, if you like, to say no guilt, not allowed.
Oh, yeah, look. You know, I completely agree. Yesterday I had to go and buy a pair of shoes because my one pair of summer shoes here are starting to fall apart. And that pair of shoes happened to be vegan. But I'm really busy. I couldn't find what I wanted on ethical fashion, or it was just way too expensive. So I decided to go for the best quality that I could afford so that I know they will last as long as possible and I will wear them every day. And so, you know, you do what you can when you with the resources that are in front of you. But just on that sort of impulse buying or the need to buy something new or pretty, I've actually recently got back into vintage shopping, and London is a fabulous place to go vintage shopping, so it's great. But I find for those kinds of purchases, I look on eBay or vintage shopping for something like that if I feel like I need to buy something extra that's not part of my capsule wardrobe. I tend to have a capsule wardrobe. It's very unexciting, actually.
No, but that's really inspiring. And that tip on vintage shopping, I mean, you know, Sydney's great for vintage shopping as well. Online is amazing for vintage shopping.
Oh, absolutely.
In the States, there are so many resources now. So it's definitely something to explore. And to even start making a bit of a mix and match of outfits so that you have a vintage piece matched with a ridiculously good quality skirt that you're just going to wear a million times, feel super proud of, so you trade it up and spent double but are buying half the amount of clothes now. You know, all these things really do help, don't they?
Yeah. And I think it's definitely right. The quality, not quantity, is definitely the way to go for ethical fashion. I tend to try and only have a wardrobe that's full of 7 outfits for winter and 7 outfits for summer, and then maybe a few extra crazy pieces in there. Just trying to kind of limit my consumption, but also just to make it actually makes life a little easier.
Does, doesn't it? Absolutely. Sometimes I think the parents at school, when I do my school drop-off and pick up for the little guy, think, you know, does she not have other options? You know, what are they doing it tough? Because I really do wear a uniform, especially in the winter. In the summer I'm a little bit more fluid with my wardrobes, a bit more varied. But in the winter I'm like 2 dresses, like wool dresses, black tights, and either the comfy chic Uggs or the really good quality leather boots. And I just do that, and it's going to be the scarf that makes it look different. That's the only thing that changes.
Absolutely. I think the most important, I think probably a top tip for your listeners in terms of vintage shopping, which is what, you know, what I follow, is make sure you know what colours suit you and what styles suit you, particularly when you're buying online. So if you've got, say, an hourglass body shape, and you know that you've got a waist, that you always need to have something that has a waist and it's defined, it might look absolutely gorgeous, but that long flowy dress, you know, is not going to suit you. So don't buy.
That is so French of you to say that. I'm half French, and my mum was one of those mums when I was a teenager, and I know she'll be listening to this podcast and probably cringe that I even mentioned her and brought her into this, but but she was so frank. She would say straight away, honestly, to my face, you look pathetic. That is showing, you know, a bulge here or a, you know. She was never one of those mums who sugarcoated how I looked in particular styles or colours. And I have to say, while it was ridiculously painful at the time and probably made me want that garment even more just because she said I didn't look good in it, looking back, it actually has helped me be really cut and dry about what works and what doesn't. And I think half of the problem of this, you know, you picture your teens shopping or the over complimentary mum or grandmother figure where everyone's always saying, oh, yeah, you look great.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need that. That is making us buy into buying. Because if we look great in everything, then of course we want everything.
Absolutely. And it's buying for your shape and buying for your colours, it really empowers you to make good choices. So you can buy less and get better wear out of what you're wearing and what you actually have in your wardrobe. And I found it extremely helpful when I first started buying this way, and it also made me feel better about my body shape and about the way I looked, because, you know, I'm not 6 foot tall, size zero model, which is what a lot of clothes are designed for. So being able to take control of and understanding what looked good on me and why really helped me with my body confidence.
Brilliant. I love this tip. And it's such an unexpected tip in the ethical, sustainable fashion conversation, if you like. But this is exactly the kind of thing that helps us evaluate and be more critical when we're scanning that shop rack and think, actually, this season doesn't work for me. You know, that shape's not for me. I'm not A-line, or I'm not pencil skirt, or, you know, whatever it might be. And then it just stops you buying because you're just being honest with yourself about whether it's going to work for you or not. I love that. That's great.
Yeah, I've got a link to my Audrey Blue website with a little bit of a guide on how to shop for your body shape. So I can send that link to you.
Fantastic. We've got that in the show notes coming then. Mm-hmm. Now, let's get on to, speaking of Audrey Blue, tell us about that, why you started it.
Well, Audrey Blue was really my first venture into this eco-fashion space, and I wanted to create a women's label that was full of really easy-to-wear, smart casual items that women could wear, you know, on the weekend or to work or wherever, to prove that we can actually produce good quality clothes at a reasonable price using a supply chain that has the highest ethical standards. And it's been going okay. At the moment, while we're getting Mighty Good off the ground, it's in a little bit of hiatus, which is a bit frustrating. I still am selling stock online, but I'm not doing any design work in there at the moment while I get my other label up and running. But basically, yeah, it was kind of that's what Audrey Blue was. It was proving that it can be done.
Brilliant. And so in terms of, you know, you mentioned at a reasonable price, did you feel that, like, think of the big guys and, you know, a lot of them listed on public stock exchanges and answering to shareholders and that kind of pressure to come in at budget or undercut and, you know, all of that race to the bottom kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that an ethical, sustainable fashion business and label can be profitable?
Yes, I think it can, because at the moment a lot of ethical fashion brands are very small scale, and when you do all the numbers, it's the small scale which actually drives up the price, because even if production is relatively cheap, you've still got these enormous fixed overheads of running a business. But if you can scale up production, you can get economies of scale in your production process. That drives down unit costs, and that can help drive down the price, even though you're still producing ethically.
I love that. So does that mean all of us out there who could stretch to the $40 T-shirt instead of the $15, $20 T-shirt, to the $100 jeans instead of the $15 to $20 jeans, should be, for the simple fact that we will be doing our duty if budget permits, and maybe it's a little reshuffle, but, you know, buy less, buy better, and all the stuff we've already talked about.
Yep.
It's our duty to actually, if we can, help grow this market so that everyone can start benefiting from some economies of scale.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's exactly why we started Mighty Good Undies brand, is to develop a range and a brand that was we would be able to scale up.
I love it. Oh, my gosh, segue professional, Anna. That was fabulous, because this leads me to ask you about this fantastic undies brand that you guys, you and the wonderful Eleanor, your business partner, who is a dear friend of mine, have come together and have had a successful crowdfunding campaign to revolutionize undies, make them extremely ethical, extremely sustainable, and as sexy or practical, depending on the style, as we want, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yep. So the thinking behind, as I said, the thinking behind Mighty Good Undies was to develop a brand that can more easily scale up, basically. Clothes are fantastic, dresses and things are fantastic, but they're at a relatively higher price point. So we wanted to develop a product that we could sell at a lower price point so that people could then try out ethical underwear. They could give it a go. They could feel how much softer the organic cotton is. They could experience buying an ethical fashion product and really use that as an entry into this whole way of thinking. So underwear is really perfect for that because it's small and you use it, you know, it's part of our daily lives and it's under your clothing, people don't see it, etc., etc. So that's how Mighty Good Undies got started. And I partnered with Elena partly because I wanted to have a team behind me this time, and I was looking for a partner who had a lot of experience in communications and PR, and that's Elena's background.
Well, with your PhD in economics and your ethical fashion background and Elena's amazing communications and just her like visual love of things being enticing and gorgeous, you know, she does such a good job of those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the two of you are a match made in heaven, and I just can't wait to see this fly.
Thank you.
Can people buy this underwear range yet?
Yeah, they can. We're going into production as we speak. We've set up our shop online on our website, and I can send you the link to that. And people were taking pre-orders for our first three styles that we are going into production for.
Wonderful.
And we hope to grow that range over time.
Yeah, great. Now, with underwear, obviously there's that stretchy kind of element to it. What is woven in with the organic cotton?
Yeah, so it's 95% organic cotton and 5% elastane. So it's a fairly standard fabric that you'd find in pretty much all of your underwear. And it's there just to give it that little bit of strength and longevity as you wash them, but also comfort as well.
Yeah, great. What's been the most exciting thing about getting this off the ground? You know, you come up with the idea and you think underwear's great, low price point, not so scary to venture into the world of ethics and organic cotton. Was there something about the whole creation process, or, you know, meeting the perfect supplier for you guys? What were some of the highlights of getting this brand off the ground?
Oh gosh, all of it. But I would say it was more of a moment rather than it was more of a feeling across a range of different moments rather than one specific point. I think because it was my idea originally, and then I went out and found Elena, and I think what's been most exciting to me is to see this project grow as both our babies and then to take on a life of its own and have other people get involved and people get really excited about it, particularly through the crowdsourcing campaign. The feedback that we got was amazing.
Oh, absolutely. So, everyone's desperate for these things to be launched. It's great.
Yeah, so that's been the most exciting sort of thing for me.
I love it. And on your website, you've got the, you know, these people make your undies. You've actually got the pictures and the stories of the people. Can you talk to us about one of those people and something about them that you find gorgeous, you know, just knowing that you're working with this person?
Oh, yeah, definitely. My favourite, the person who always inspires me whenever I feel like I get overwhelmed or like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? I always think of Rajat Jaipuria, who is the owner of the factory who's going to be making our undies, Raj Lakshmi Cotton Mills. Rajat So the cotton mills are a family-owned factory. They've been in the family for about 80 years.
Oh, wow.
They are a family that's very concerned and very passionate about the welfare of their community. And they deliberately set up in Kolkata in West Bengal in India because it was the location in India where they saw they needed to create jobs. You know, they had a choice of being able to establish all their way over, you know, all around India, but they chose that particular city because it was where their family came from and where they needed jobs. So they started the factory with this great social ambition. And then when Rajat took over from his father, I think it was about 15, 20 years ago, he converted the factory into a certified fair trade and organic cotton factory. And that's what they focus on. It's their passion. It's what they really want to do. And I think probably, if not 100%, then close to 100% of their production is certified organic and fair trade cotton. They might take on a few other jobs just, you know, to pay the bills. But they are really, it's part of their DNA, their business DNA, producing ethically. And so being able to support him to create demand for his business through his business to create demand through the supply chain is the most exciting thing for me. Plus Rajat is a lovely gentleman. He is warm, friendly, a little on the shy side, which is very endearing.
Oh, beautiful.
Always ready to help. He's an absolutely gorgeous man. So I'm really excited. Yeah,
that's it.
He's always inspiring me. Yep.
Now, you mentioned briefly that you had, that you admitted to sometimes having a, oh my gosh, I can't do this. moment. And, you know, I think for all the business owners, or actually, in fact, everyone has these, I can't do this, freak out days, you know, what does your give up day look like? You know, we've all had them. And how do you as a person work to kind of just get over yourself and get your mojo back?
I think two things. Occasionally I take a day off and go and spend time in outdoor green space.
You've got a startup and you take a day off? This is, wow, Hannah, luxury.
I know, outrageous. I try and make sure that I spend any days off that I have outdoors in some green space, hopefully with my husband at the same time, not always. I think also I make sure that I have a good team around me, and I think that's one of the reasons why Elena and I work, is that if I'm having a panicky day of, oh, my God, this is all too much, et cetera, I call her up and we just talk it through. And she says to me, don't panic. You know, I do the same for her as well. Don't panic. We've got this. We can only do what we can do. And we just start working. We start listing out and we start working out what the problems are and what our priorities are. And I think for me, dealing with those moments, I think it's really critical to have people that you can go and have a brain dump on, or a bleh, or
that's
a,
so you know, key, isn't it? You actually need to have
what
the
am
people,
I doing?
Yeah, yeah, that you can feel comfortable to brain dump on.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I think that's really critical. And here in London, I found a co-working, a shared working space that I have made a fabulous network of other women working on their own businesses. And we do that with each other. It's like, oh my God, or I'm doing this, or I'm overwhelmed, or, you know, so we have this culture in that space of being able to do that and being able to work through problems in a mutually supportive way.
Beautiful. And I think once you, as you said, once you see those problems or all the things causing the overwhelm can quite often be because it hasn't been dumped onto a list. And once it's on paper, you're like, oh, okay, that's just a series of jobs and I'll just start off with number one.
Yes.
way easier. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And that's, yeah, something I have to get better at, as everyone keeps on telling me, write everything down. Don't keep everything in your head. But I also think it's important to realise that this is normal. You know, you're not being a failure. You're not being a freak if you have one of these freak out days. It's normal. Everybody goes through it. Everybody deals with it.
Mm. And we're not special for having one either. And that will stop us from indulging too far into it, you know, because at the end of the day, yes, we're allowed the freak out, But no, we're not allowed to stay there. We have the brain dump, we make the list, we make a plan, and we get the heck on with it. Because otherwise, yeah, it becomes this indulgent, overanalyzed, bigger problem that simply isn't that big most of the time when we just do what we need to do to get out of the funk.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that Elena and I did when we finished the crowdsourcing campaign is this: we took 5 minutes just to reflect back on what we've achieved as well. So we had this enormous big, you know, to-do list and things to get to Berlin, but we made sure that we also stopped and celebrated with each other, even if it was just remotely. The champagne will wait till we get to Berlin. You know, what we've actually achieved so far. And again, that's a really great way of reinforcing your confidence that you can do this. It's not rocket science. You know, you just keep at it. And I think one of my biggest lessons I learned from my PhD, and it's certainly a lesson that I brought into my business, was just keep at it. Just do something. Just keep at it. You know, you just got to keep going.
Just keep at it. We need T-shirts, ethical, organic cotton T-shirts. If you could make those for us with "just keep at it" written on the front, I dare say many of us would probably do well to go to bed wearing one of those so that that's the first thing we see in the morning.
Yeah, because it often that's the difference. In fact, if I had to pick only one thing between failure and success, it's that. Mm. It's stubborn, dogged commitment to what you're going to achieve.
Yeah.
You know, and I try and make progress every day, even if it's just sending one email or doing one tiny little thing. I try and make progress every day. Just keep at it.
I love it. This is such a good tangent. I just think, you know, this is gold, and it just applies to so many different people and all of our lives, you know, anyone. You know, maybe you're finding motherhood difficult. Maybe you're finding the new job difficult. You don't have to necessarily work for yourself. These are things that we all face. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks for indulging that little tangent. It was actually a bit mammoth, but, you know, I'm the tangent queen. So
my pleasure. I love tangents too, yes. It's where you find some of the joy in life.
You totally do. You find the nuggets. Okay, so Mighty Good Undy has successfully crowdfunded. You guys are in production now. You're heading to Berlin for the ethical fashion. Is it a festival or is it a big expo? What's happening in Berlin?
It's a big trade show.
Okay.
So this shows how much notice I take of mainstream fashion. It is Fashion Week next week in Berlin, but there's several different major, as well as all the glamorous kind of fashion shows that you would expect in Fashion Week, there's also quite a number of trade shows. And so this particular one we're going to is a trade show specifically for ethical fashion from around Europe.
Brilliant. And so is this where you hope to be seen by department stores or, you know, Whole Foods in America, or, you know, is this the kind of place that buyers are coming and checking out what's new? And
absolutely it is, yes. So we're hoping, at the moment, being a small company, we're hoping to find distributors in different countries. But basically, you know, because we're at the start of our journey, we're open to talking to anybody, you know, on any opportunity, and we're really kind of putting ourselves out there to the universe, so to speak, and see what we get back.
That's very exciting. Well, I wish you heaps of success next week. Now, I ask you for a couple of tips to finish off our convo?
Sure.
Convo, that's so Australian. For any one from the United States or from the UK, that means conversation in any other language, but we shorten everything in Australia so you can have a little laugh at us. Now, your favourite documentary. So someone's listened to us, they're like, oh, my gosh, I've never thought about fashion. Where am I going to go to learn next? Have you got a couple of go-to books, blogs to follow or documentaries that we can share with the listeners?
I think the book The High Price of Cheap by Elizabeth Klein really opened my eyes.
Yeah.
Fabulous book. I'm really looking forward to reading Tansy Hopkins. Oh, what's her book called? The name's it's just gone out of my brain at the moment.
That's okay. We'll pop it in the show notes.
Yep. I think the True Cost movie is a really important thing to see.
Ugh.
Yeah. The Guardian has had, the Guardian newspaper has had a series of incredible broader investigative journalistic pieces on the Rana Plaza disaster and on child labour, particularly in the fashion industry, and they're certainly worth checking out.
Yeah.
I think that's where, yeah, where I would start.
Mm. And I think I might just add one there. To Die For is a great book.
Yes. Yeah. Lucy C.
Yes, course. Exactly. And the wonderful thing that I learnt from her when I saw a friend interview her at the Opera House a couple of years ago was, I think, would I wear this? Do I love it that much to wear this at least 30 times?
Yeah.
What a metric for choosing your clothes, hey?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, there's quite a campaign on at the moment in the UK around that. Livia Firth, Colin Firth's wife, is a really big champion.
Eco-age.
Yeah.
Is
yes. that
right? Or, yeah.
Yeah, I pronounce it eco-age, yeah.
my half-Frenchy coming out. I want it to sound a bit more posh.
Eco-age. Well, she's Italian, so I don't know how she pronounces it. But she has been championing, she's been running that campaign, and it's a fabulous thing. And when I first saw it, I thought, only 30 wears, but actually I realised that most people only wear their clothes 4 or 5 times, at least.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, so, yeah, she's fantastic to follow on Instagram and to see the green carpet challenge where amazing stars wear these gorgeous ethical gowns, and it's really helping to show that this isn't just about, you know, hippies in some off-the-grid town wearing hemp, scratchy hemp tops. This is about, you know, we can still look beautiful, we can still feel sexy, as we've talked about, like that critical thing where we actually wear clothes that suit us for a start in terms of our body shape and style. You know, it's totally possible. Yeah, it's really exciting. So speaking of body shape, jeans is something we all buy. What are a couple of your go-to brands? Doesn't have to be Australian, and people are listening from all over the place. Go-to jeans brand that you might have uncovered.
Well, at the moment, I'm waiting for my jeans to wear out. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting really excited about Nudie jeans.
Okay.
I finally worked out that they actually sell to women too, but also the label Good Society, which is a European label. But actually, a really, really, really exciting thing that's happening is with Levi's. They are doing some incredible work at the moment on reducing water waste and improving the environmental impacts of their jeans. And they're also they're doing some experimental work creating jeans out of recycled cotton fibre.
Wow. So
Levi's are definitely my go-to jeans.
So it's post-consumer cotton.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. With a company called Envry. I think it's still experimental, but what it really shows is a company and a company management that's really committed to improving their supply chain and doing some really fundamental changes to their supply chain. So, and they're, you know, one of the most well-known brands in the world. Everyone can access them. They're certainly my go-to brand.
Oh, I'm excited. And, you know, it's kind of like Lego committing to being petroleum free. It's kind of like IKEA committing to 100% sustainability. You know, there are big leaders
saying, absolutely,
you know, we're brave enough to shoot for 100%. So who's with us? And that just encourages more people in other industries. And, you know, what a beautiful thing where instead of the competition being a race to the cheapest, it's a race to the most ethical story to tell. And to have as a part of your brand DNA to do the best for the world. That just gets, instead of this spiraling down energy that we have in all production, industrial production, it helps us spiral up. And if you think about that energetically, not to get too woo-woo, but it just makes everything happier, brighter, more beautiful.
I'm going to adopt that term, more woo-woo. That's fantastic. Well, no, and definitely that's what we need in the industry. We need industry leaders, both at the small scale, which is what we're trying to do, but also at the larger scale as well. And so it's really exciting to see what Levi's are doing. So if anybody out there is listening who works at Levi's, thank you. Fantastic.
Yay.
High five to you.
I love it. Gosh, we have uncovered so much in this chat. I'm very excited for your mighty good undies to be sharing the goodness with the world. So there will be so many links in our show notes, because this is obviously one of those topics that is still in its infancy of being understood. You know, we're still very low confidence, if you like, as a population in terms of knowledge, in terms of how to shop for, how to find. And I'm going to be listing some of my favorite organic, ethical, GOTS certified brands as well that you guys can check out, as well as those books, documentaries, and any further research that you might want to do. So the show notes today are packed with extra resources for anyone who's keen to start digging into this topic. Thank you, Hannah, so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful English summer's day. I'm going to wind down now on my side of the world and probably have a cup of tea and write up these show notes. So thank you, and I really look forward to bringing you in a year's time when we have to revisit Mighty Good Undie, because you guys are like iconic emblems of the fashion industry revolution into ethics. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited. Much. We're all sending you good vibes for Berlin.
Thank you very much for your kind words.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode of the Low Tox Life podcast. I would love for you to check out the show notes as well, and you can find those at lowtoxlife.com/podcast. Now, if there's anything that inspired you from today's episode, I would so love to hear and have you share that, maybe online. Use the Low Tox Life hashtag, and I can be found on Twitter or Instagram at @alex_Stuart, Stuart. Now, if you liked what you heard today and you want to join us again next time, subscribing is a great way to be notified of a new episode. So hit subscribe, and I look forward to welcoming you next time. Bye for now.
For your ears.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.